This week on the Eldritch Lorecast,
Cynthia Williams has gone on permanent holiday.
It happens. These things happen.
Steve Jackson Games. GURPS didn't release a physical book in 2023.
You tell me what GURPS stands for.
I don't know what the G is.
The G stands for GURPS.
Pathfinder War of Immortals.
I'm simultaneously, it's exciting. It's that event brain again. But there's a little part of me that's like, oh no, it's happening again.
I have a question.
What is your question?
Who is going to develop the next Baldur's Gate game?
I will do it. But if it comes out in the next 2 years... I'm gonna fight someone.
All that and more right now.
3, 2, 1. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of the Eldritch Lorecast, the number one tabletop RPG dice picnic corporate news information podcast in all the world. That's
catchy.
Right. If you want a press conference, you've come to the right place. My name is Ben Byrne, joined, as always, by Sean Merwin, Dale Kingsmill, and returning this week, James Hake. James, how was your holiday?
Fantastic. Went to Japan for 2 weeks, started in Hiroshima, went to Osaka, Kyoto, and then Tokyo. And boy, it was just a time in my life. I mean, I walked like 20,000 steps every day. I saw so many sights. I lost 10 pounds. I ate great food. I mean, I had an amazing vacation. And maybe more than any of those things individually, I came back incredibly inspired to write some more. To do some cool stuff that I'd been lacking, the creative verve, I think, to feel like I could execute properly. And now that I'm over my jet lag, my 72 hours of misery post returning to my home time zone, I now feel like I can do that again.
Dale Kingsmill, also with us today. I feel like I've asked what is your best holiday before on this episode, probably when James went away last time. So this time I'm going to ask, what was your worst holiday experience that you can remember?
What was my worst holiday experience?
Yeah. What was your worst?
I can't even remember holiday experiences.
And Sean immediately goes into thinking.
Yeah. Look, I mean, I don't think it's a secret at this point that I do not cope with flying long distances. So just in general, going a long way to get to a place is my worst holiday experience. It's like, here you are 15 hours on a plane having panic attacks, and then now you have to stand in line. Like, it isn't fun. It's not a fun time. But I'm trying to think of, like, because I travel for sort of a mix of business and holiday, I'm trying to think of the actual holiday parts that have been bad. There are very few of those, really, because once you're actually in a very beautiful place, it's difficult to feel curmudgeonly.
That's very pleasant. I appreciate your canter.
Once when I was a kid, we went to Tasmania and we stayed in this old house, and there was this big freaky pink panther toy that was like bigger than human sized on a rocking chair in the bedroom upstairs. And then I slipped down the stairs. So maybe that.
Was the house haunted?
It felt haunted. There was a graveyard in the backyard.
I'm going to slit your throat when you're asleep.
That sounds like the best holiday. Let's do this.
Can someone run a fate campaign for us?
Sean, what about yourself? Worst holiday you've ever been on?
I was probably 17 and my family decided, yeah, we should go to Disney World once in a car with 6 people with no air conditioning in a... like 36-hour drive in this dead of summer to Florida, where we were crushed in this small hotel room altogether. It was pretty brutal, yeah.
See, it's the logistics of holidays that make them suck.
Yes, that is true. I am just as happy having a staycation as a vacation. And even when I go on vacation, I am happy to spend more on the hotel than I am on any activities. I'm a kind of like go to a resort, sit on a beach kind of dude, as opposed to like go mountain climbing and whitewater rapid rafting.
I will say this, though, Ben. I stayed in hostels the entire time I was in New Zealand on the way over to PAX Oz last year. And I loved it so much that I stayed in hostels almost the entire time I was in Japan as well. There's just something... I don't know what it is. Can you hear the construction happening downstairs? Can you hear that thumping?
We can, but I don't think it's a problem.
Okay.
That's Dante's problem.
Let me just say, if you're afraid of staying in hostels for just like you know, I've never done it before reasons, it's worth trying. Like, don't do it if you're bringing like kids or your parents along or whatever. But if it's just you and like a brother, backpacking friends or whatever, hostels are really good and they're really cheap. They're in interesting places.
Yeah, it's not hostels so much. I'm not opposed to staying in a hostel. One of my worst holiday experiences, which was relatively recent, it was right before COVID. It was literally February 2020, right before COVID hit Australian shores. And my wife and I were up in the hills, like completely isolated, no internet. We thought it would be hilarious. What if a zombie apocalypse happened right now? Nobody would know. And then COVID. But the thing that made this place where we stayed particularly horrifying was that the house was just filled with spiders. Just absolutely filled. They were mostly daddy long legs, so it was kind of okay. But there were a couple of bigger, blacker spiders. And also, my wife at one point called out. She's like, come here. There's a spider in here. And I came in and it wasn't a spider, at least not on its own. It was a scorpion and a spider fighting each other. The scorpion had its tail caught in the web.
I think this was some kind of a portent that you should have paid attention to. That was a warning that COVID was coming.
You could be right, actually. You could be right.
You get entertainment, a place to stay, and then food when you're done. It sounds like a win-win-win to me.
I can't believe you would spit in their face like this, Ben.
Just like a bit of crab, you know, that's what it tastes like. Love a bit of scorpion. Anyway, speaking of going on holiday, let's dive into the news, because Cynthia Williams, the ex-president of Wizards of the Coast, sorry, I should correct myself there, has gone on permanent holiday from her job as president of Wizards of the Coast. According to an SEC filing, Cynthia Williams gave her resignation on April 15th, effective April 26th, which is 3 days from today. Hasbro is currently searching for her successor, both internally and externally at Hasbro and Wizards of the Coast. No reason officially has been given, though various statements Hasbro provided express excitement as well as well wishes for Cynthia's career endeavor. So it seems like she is moving on from the company entirely.
It happens. These things happen. We know that it's likely that she resigned rather than being fired, based on the fact that they seem surprised by it and are doing a search and are publicly talking about that search. As to the meaning behind it, who knows? It could be anything. The only thing I take from it is if Ms. Williams wants to stay in the industry as an executive, it's usually a bad look to leave something after less than about 3 years. 3 years is generally the, okay, here's my legacy. I was able to put together this plan and carry it through. Cool. 2 years is a little short, which tells me either it was done because it was sort of an emergency situation in terms of personal reasons, or it was done because she may have seen some bad stuff coming down the pike. You don't want to be stuck with that as your legacy. You want to be able to say, well, I left in April of 2024 and all of this bad stuff that happened at the end of 2024.
The house was not on fire when I left.
Exactly. When in fact, the house can be on fire for 3 years after you leave and it still could be your fault. You can't be blamed for some things that people might blame on you, and you can't take credit for things that you may deserve credit on, because we don't know what's going on behind the scenes for any of the successes or failures that have come in the last 8 years.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, there's a list of kind of that I took notes of from various articles that I was writing in terms of like what successes did Wizards of the Coast have during Cynthia's time and what kind of missteps were taken under Cynthia. And as you say, it's kind of hard to be able to attribute these exclusively or explicitly to her and her time as president, A, because there's so many other decision makers going into a lot of these things happening, and B, because, you know, these plans can be years in advance. You know, she's getting clapped on the back for Monopoly Go, which came out last year, I think, maybe like 10 months ago, which was well into her time. Keeping in mind that she wasn't just the president of Wizards of the Coast, she also oversaw, I believe, Hasbro Entertainment. So So she was a kind of the gaming side of things in general, I believe. Monopoly Go was a huge earner for them over the last little while. And I believe she was brought into the company from Microsoft to help that kind of Chris Cox blueprint of moving more towards digital licensing as much as, you know, producing their own gaming content. But was Monopoly Go in the works for 5-6 years before, or maybe not that long, but like 3-4 years before Cynthia was actually in that seat? It's impossible to know.
She was in the driver's seat for when the whole OGL thing happened.
That is true.
And I don't want to add speculative fuel to the fire. It's why I'm cautious of saying anything, because I have no internal knowledge of whatever corporate ballyhoo is going on. And because, as we said, it's very likely that she resigned in a surprising move to other powers that be at Hasbro and Wizards of the Coast, it seems unlikely that it's like, oh, well, look at the disaster that she presided over, out of here, right? It doesn't seem like that's likely. But I have to wonder if, you know, if you're working at Wizards, just like Sean said, if you're in that sort of position, you're like, well, things have been rough lately. They've been good too, but there's been a lot of bad PR. Maybe I'd like to get to a company that has better PR than this, that isn't as open to attack by its fans for every little thing. I don't know. Maybe in the digital age, it's impossible to find such a company, such a media company in any case.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's been a lot of speculation online from YouTubers that I think, you know, there were some videos I couldn't even get through. I was just like, this is completely off base. But then, you know, other folks just kind of pointing out, much to my agreeance, which is like, this doesn't really matter to your average person who's playing D&D, right? No, I couldn't name. Oh, well, actually, I could. It's Chris Cox. We know that because he got promoted up to CEO of Hasbro. But before that, you know, I have no idea who the president of Wizards of the Coast was. I wouldn't know Chris Cox if he hadn't been promoted up to being president of, or CEO rather. Trying to get the titles correct. CEO of Hasbro, president of WotC. So, you know, what difference does this make to your average gamer playing D&D around their kitchen table on a Saturday night? Nothing, I don't think. I think you're right that the OGL stuff probably was something she was part of the decision-making for. I don't necessarily think she was the one who personally called the Pinkertons, you know? I think that she might have said, like, hey, we need to get those magic cards off the street, but then somebody else made that phone call. Like,
get those magic cards off the street.
I've got to get them out of the hands of the civvies. So I don't think that she can be congratulated or admonished for, you know, all the missteps or all the things that Hasbro has done or Wizards have done over the last little while. Some folks have said, but again, this is just speculative and kind of rumory, that her resignation is convenient, that it comes just a few days before an earnings call that's coming from Wizards next week. So maybe she wanted to get out before that became public because it looks better for her or maybe she just got a good opportunity, you know, elsewhere. Maybe she got headhunted by back into the video game industry somewhere or the technology industry. So
all I can say is the optics are interesting. That's all I got.
And the funny thing is, technically, the earnings call is the 24th. And her resignation goes into effect the 26th.
So go it on a high note, maybe.
Whatever that means.
Just sunglasses, muddy, raining down.
Yeah.
Explosion. Poof. I'm out. We'll have to wait and see.
As usual, we get scooped on the news. Can't believe it. Right after a Lorecast.
All right. That's just going to be the... That's going to be the thumbnail now, is your Cynthia Williams with sunglasses and an explosion of money. Like,
I don't want to be the next president of Wizards of the Coast.
No, it doesn't seem enviable, apart from the money.
I love seeing all of the memes on Twitter about it, because they're all talking about things like, it's like, you know that the president of WotC doesn't get to do those things, right?
Well, that's just it. I feel like it's difficult for me to speak on, because frankly, I have no idea what a CEO of Wizards of the Coast does, apart from get those Magic the Gathering cards off the street.
Off the street. Well, they are looking internally and externally. So if you have C-suite experience and love gaming, or like telling people that you love gaming, no D&D experience required, as was evident.
Watch him scoop up Bobby Kotick. Wouldn't that be just a kick in the pants?
Why would you do that? Why would you put that out there?
Yes.
Speaking of kind of more industry style news, Steve Jackson Games, of GURPS fame, of Munchkin fame, the card game, if you're a Munchkin fan, or board game as well. I think Munchkin's kind of its own little thing now. The Fantasy Trip RPG fame, they put out an annual stakeholders report, importantly not a shareholders report, because Steve Jackson Games is owned privately. It's not owned by shareholders. But they feel the need to put out a stakeholders report because they consider their fans, their staff, you know, people with stakes basically in the company, maybe not in the economical sense, although very economical. Anyway, they put out a statement saying that in 2023, they made $3.5 million in gross revenue, I believe is the number, which is down from $4.7 in 2022, which is not great for them. Feeling that the reasons why were because GURPS didn't release a physical book in 2023. The Fantasy Trip, their other RPG, is underperforming, and there was a bestiary that they had that was going to go out for that, which was delayed. Munchkin Digital, doing well. That was the big earner. And also increased shipping and manufacturing costs and logistics, creating pressure, causing delays, which is kind of an industry-wide issue. You know, manufacturing costs haven't come down since COVID, really. And also, there are some things going on in the world that make it difficult for boats to sail in certain waters, so to speak. But despite this, Steve Jackson saying that the industry, I thought this was interesting. This is why I kind of put this on there, apart from the kind of meat and potatoes news of it, thinks that we're in a golden age for gamers with more variety and sheer volume than ever before. Taking a very strong disagree with the author of the D&D history book from a couple of months ago.
I think it's interesting the idea that not putting out a physical book would be a reason for less earning. Putting out a physical book is obviously more expensive than putting out digital stuff, you know what I mean? But evidently there's kind of this idea attached to the release of a physical book that makes it more of an event, more exciting. It's more exciting to get a physical thing into your hands. And I'm kind of stuck on that interplay between the cost of a more exciting thing, but the potential gains of it.
Is it easier to market a physical book than a digital book?
Well, it depends on what you mean by easier, doesn't it? Like, So we talk about this thing called the long tail effect that I'm sure that I've brought up before. And there's, I mean, it kind of gets muddied because print on demand exists, but there's this element of physical items where you have to physically store them. You have to physically have shelf space to put that thing, right? Which is why games like D&D end up, you know, you in your local game store, it's got to be D&D stuff, not these other smaller indie games, because if you have to dedicate shelf space to it, you're going to dedicate it to the thing that you know is going to sell, right?
Sure.
So there's a lot of costs indicated in that aspect of having a physical thing that also mean that when you're marketing it, you have to choose where you're selling it. You have to choose, okay, well, we know that more people in this city are going to buy it, so we're not going to sell it in this other city. So there's, it gets complicated in that degree versus digital products. It's really easy to just give them a link. You know what I mean? Like, it's the easiest thing in the world. You can make a billion ads, put them on a billion websites, and people can just click through. And it becomes just a matter of conversion rates from click through to actual purchase, which is in many ways strictly simpler. But whether it's as effective, I suppose, is a different thing.
The spirit of the question, and I don't know the answer, it's a genuine question, is it easier from a marketing perspective to excite people about a physical product versus a digital product, you know? Yeah, I don't really have an elaboration on that.
Well, I don't have an answer.
I wonder why, because video games get people excited about a digital product all the time, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Like, even though tabletop games are, historically speaking, a physical product, they are not even, maybe even primarily a physical product in the 2020s. I don't have the numbers on physical sales versus D&D Beyond sales right now, for example, but like,
of course,
everything is transitioning to a more and more digital space. So what is it about a physical book that gives prestige to a tabletop product? Is it because
that's the
it takes
word,
up
prestige
shelf space, over there, right? Because I've got this big, you know, row of black and red on my shelf. Does it give me some sort of value as a human to be able to display my interest in a way that I couldn't in a digital space? Maybe. I don't know. There does seem to be a lot of sort of, you know, consumption-based identity pride in the tabletop space, especially when a lot of identity pride comes from, I don't play D&D. Or sure. I do play D&D, unlike you hipster mofos. I don't know. I'm making everyone mad right now.
Yeah. I don't know. I think for me, to elaborate on the question a little bit, and the hypothesis is that in terms of it being easier to excite a person about a physical product, is that a physical RPG book is more tangible as a thing, because RPGs themselves and RPG rule sets, at least to me, are a little bit intangible because they're words on a page that we then agree to, decide they do things when we say them to each other at the table. Whether as a video game, like I'm playing Fallout at the moment, big surprise, I can't decide that I'm going to play Fallout as a pacifist because I just wouldn't get very far through the game. Or I can't decide suddenly that I'm going to fly a jet in Fallout. But that might be possible in some capacity in D&D because I, you know, use a magic item, broom of flying, and then I build a chassis around it. Now I've got a jet. You know what I mean?
At least with the tabletop RPG industry, I think it's a matter of like hacking into event brain, right? Mm-hmm. Like, because if you think about the contexts in which physical products tend to get released within the TTRPG space, you've got your big D&D releases where sometimes they'll have an event wrapped around it, like D&D Live or whatever. Or, you know, it'll be, oh, it's releasing in stores today. Go and get your special, you know, your special edition cover. It's only available in physical stores. Or on the other end, you've got most indie games, I would say, are funded by crowdfunding. And it becomes part of that crowdfunder event that it's like, yeah, sure, you can chip in, you know, $20 or whatever and get the digital copy. Or you can chip in $120 and you get this fancy box that has all these things in it, or you get these minis with it, or, you know, and it becomes physicalized in the context of this exciting event that you can kind of all come together and be like, ooh, this is exciting.
Was the word prestige used? Because I think that's it, right? If you, and it's not just as the purchaser, it's as the game design company. Wizards of the Coast can put out a box set with minis and dice. Can you? Can you, Paizo, continue to do that? Yes. Yes, you can. Well, you're still up there then. Can you, Hit Point Press? Yes. Via Kickstarter? Okay, great. Then you are here, right? And that becomes the standard by which you are a real company as opposed to somebody who's just sort of making things.
I haven't even considered that it might be prestige from a production level.
About it being a golden age, it is. It is still a golden age for not just the players, but for the industry as a whole. Just because we hit a false apex in 2020 because of COVID doesn't mean that we're still not seeing results that we've never seen before. On a blog called Bat in the Attic, someone looked at total downloads from the DMs Guild. In 2007, there were about 300,000 downloads total. By 2012, it hit 1 million downloads. By 2016, they hit 2.5 million. 2020 saw 6.5 million downloads. So you go from 2018, which was about 3.5 million, to 2020, which was 6.5 million, almost doubling. Then in 2021, it went down to 4.5 million, and it held steady at 4.5 million for the last 3 years. Well, that's still five times higher than it was in 2015, but it's receding a bit because of, I think, that false apex that we hit because of the pandemic and isolation and so on. So I think we're still there. It's just we've had to readjust our expectations, both as an industry business, right? Oh, look what we made in 2020. Let's plan to double that in 2021. Wait, where'd everyone go? Oh, you were able to leave your house? Oh, well, we should probably reassess where we stand. And I think hopefully we on the business side of things are being able to reassess now. And as Steve Jackson here did, to right size things.
Yeah, they're talking about for their company going forward, you know, not to be too ambitious in the things that they make and let kind of scope creep because of like cool things that they might want to try and do. They, you know, just want to make the cool books that they've committed to making and stay on deadline for themselves for the immediate future, right. Just while they work to kind of stabilize their company. We're going to quickly skip that Critical Role through Matthew Lillard's company are putting out Sankeg's Hide Whiskey. It's a whiskey product. They picked a barrel and they slapped a label on it because the barrel's been aging for 4+ years, but this licensing agreement has to be less than 6 months old. So there you go. The cast get to choose the final blend, though. That's that news. Anyway, moving on. What I thought was interesting that Critical Role did recently was everybody was going on about the latest episode of Critical Role. Spoilers for the latest episode of Critical Role. There's timestamps in the description if you want to avoid spoilers for the episode if you haven't seen it yet. Apparently, it's a big hubbub-a-blue. You can skip ahead in this episode. But there is an interesting thing here because I was like, okay, something happened in Critical Role. What happened in Critical Role? Here's the spoilery bit. One of the main cast's characters died. Fresh cut grass blew themselves up.
Wow, we're just going, wow, we're leaping straight.
I gave spoiler warning.
I know, but it was spoiler like, warning. Spoiler warning, bam!
Okay, all right, I'm sorry everybody in the chat. blew themselves up to kill a villain who was, it was a very difficult battle. This villain had been encountered earlier in the campaign, so the, pardon me, the villain had been encountered earlier in the campaign, so the party had like an attachment to them. Last time this villain was encountered, somebody else had died in the party and everybody else had been brought close to death. So high emotional stakes here as they encounter this villain again. And they're all getting, you know, damaged and put down and they're running out of spell slots and it's calamity and it's, oh, man, no, we're all going to die. This is not good. And then Fresh Cut Grass casts a spell on himself. I think it was Guiding Bolt on himself. Get rid of his own hit points and causes himself to explode. It's been established before that Fresh Cut Grass has a bomb in their chest, so it's a big, massive explosion. Here's the interesting bit. They used some rules from Daggerheart to make this moment in the game happen because Daggerheart's death rules allow a player, when their character is going to or about to die, choose between, no, I definitely want my character to live no matter what, I want the dice to decide and, you know, we'll just see where the dice roll. Or I want to go out in a blaze of glory. And it says that you and the GM discuss what would be an appropriate thing for your character to accomplish within the world of your setting for your blaze of glory. And one of the things it explicitly says is you kill the big bad boss no matter how many hit points it has left, which seems to be what they did here. And this is not just speculative because the entire time the cast were using the term Blaze of Glory, which is the rule that is in Daggerheart. And I just thought it was an interesting way to sort of sneak this little reference to their new rules system and show how it would work in play and show the great drama it creates and all of that sort of stuff.
Clever way to do it as well, because you want to slide those rules in a big moment. You want it to be something that people will pay attention to not something that kind of fades into the background that no one noticed. I think it's a smart move. I think it's a good idea.
I 100% agree. I also want to say, though, that the other thing it demonstrates is the incredible flexibility of the D&D system, where you can slap on a rule from a completely outside game and have D&D continue to function more or less as intended, which of course is the hard thing for any game like Daggerheart to overcome because of the sort of ubiquity of D&D and its broad customizability.
Yeah, I wanted to say that same thing, but people get mad when you say that 5e is like infinitely hackable. They're like, there is a better system for doing that thing. And it's like, I'm sure other systems are also hackable.
Well, yeah, I mean, here's the thing, right? Like, I've seen a billion Skyrim mods, right? And most of the mods I see in Skyrim that have other games that do that sort of thing. I don't have an example off the top of my head. I wish I did. But like, whenever I see something that is modded into Skyrim, I look for the game that did it. Like, if you had sort of Dishonored style teleportation and assassination, right? Modded into Skyrim. Right. Dishonored would still do it better. But you love Skyrim and you know Skyrim, so you're going to mod it into Skyrim because you want, you don't want Dishonored. You want Skyrim with the Dishonored thing in it.
That's a really good way of encapsulating that, I think, for folk who get frustrated at the incessant hacking of D&D 5e that happens.
The only difference is that it's easier to, pop in Dishonored and play it rather than rope your six friends into wanting to play Dishonored with you.
All right. Spoilers concluded.
But speaking of intense D&D 5e encounters, Monsters of Drakenheim is in its final few hours of funding. It is, if you're listening to this on YouTube or Spotify, there is probably less than 24 hours left in the campaign. So if you want to jump on Monsters of Drakenheim, if you want 150 plus new monsters for 5e, sometimes you don't want to create new monsters yourself all the time. Hey, I got a solution for you. Crack open Monsters of Drakenheim. We got aberrations. We got funguses. We've got whatever the hell this thing that Dante's going to put on the screen right now is. Sorry if you're in the Twitch chat.
Sorry if you're in our viewpoint. We don't get to see it either.
What's that about? Actually, I've got good news for you. You could go check it out right now by following the link in the chat, which will link you to the Kickstarter campaign.
You can see all the horrible monsters. I'll accept the segue.
That was real smooth.
Thank you. Smooth like the skin of the Cthulian horrors that you could be fighting using Monsters of Drakenheim right now. Pathfinder War of Immortals is moving past one of their deities because they are going to die. This is just some Pathfinder news for you. The Pathfinder
corner. Wow, you're becoming a real radio DJ today.
The news here, there's a lot going on in Pathfinder. I found it a little bit difficult to parse it all. I apologize to Pathfinder fans. But the big kind of announcement here, if you're not a Pathfinder fan but interested, is that War of Immortals is a new product coming out in October, including a bunch of new player options, the new classes, the Animist and the Exemplar, which we talked about last year when they were in playtest, are going to be in that book in their final form. New mythic play from the description of the marketing, kind of like high level mythical, fighting gods and monsters kind of play, mythic destinies for your characters, weapons, items, spells for mythic characters, new monsters, mythic monsters for big scale campaigns. It all sounds very cool. But the book also exploring the aftermath of the death of Gorum, the god of war, whose blood and armor and divine essence is literally going to rain down onto Galarian and create havoc on the mortal realm as people try to gather parts of their divine essence and wield it for power. Pathfinder seems like it's real in a real like comic book kind of thing in the way that they like move their story along. They create new things for it. There's something about the D&D lore that seems a bit more, for the Forgotten Realms, it seems a bit more ephemeral compared to Pathfinder
more
lore.
Like
which
it's
feels
in
like
the past.
Yeah. It's all just kind of, it could have happened or it might not have happened or it has happened or maybe it's going to happen in the future, in regards to Forgotten Realms lore, whereas Pathfinder lore feels like you are playing a worldly campaign altogether, and this happens in everyone's campaign in some capacity.
There was a time when that was really common in D&D in the 90s and in other RPG systems too, like World of Darkness. The age of the meta plot was a huge thing in the 90s where in Planescape, for example, there was this whole thing, the Great Modron March, where the spirit of the recently killed demon lord Orcus had revived himself as a shadowy remnant and subverted the prime Modron and forced all of his creations to go wandering throughout the plains early, causing havoc as they went, and that would have these knock-on effects, bum, 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 out throughout the plains. And it was a big deal. And then probably about less than a year later, it was all over, on to the next thing, let's deal with the consequences of that. The pacing of metaplots became hard to deal with, because unless you were extremely plugged in, what was happening, which, let me tell you, was harder in the 90s than it is in the 2020s. You would quickly fall behind, and you would be like, I have no idea what's going on in D&D anymore. And there's a problem you can still see in, like, Marvel comics, right? We're more plugged in now again. But, like, you know, if you miss a couple issues of Marvel, it's like, ah, oh, what's happening in the new crossover event? Why is Spider-Man dead? What's going on?
Surreal.
So D&D had kind of reacted to that information in the first decade of the 2000s, which we still don't have a satisfactory name for yet, and chose to not just practically do away with long form adventures entirely, but also do away with large scale sequential adventure paths entirely. And so for Paizo to, it was Paizo who revived the long form adventure path when they were publishing Dungeon and Dragon magazine near the end of that decade. And so even though it surprises me that any RPG company would go back to a major meta plot format, makes more sense now. We're more connected now. We can keep up with the changes now if you're not playing. But it makes a lot of sense that Paizo is the one to do it, given that not only you mentioned comic books, Paizo loves comic books. There's so many Pathfinder comic books, and they're actually pretty good. So it makes sense they've got a sort of comic booky mindset to it. But because they like to push into long form content, it's interesting and sensical. They're pushing into kind of the longest form content they can get away with in the RPG space.
The one thing that does concern me a little bit is that towards the end of Pathfinder 1, there was a lot of content. It was a lot of content. And it's not to say that that doesn't exist in things like 5e as well, but in terms of, like, Pathfinder kind of go all in pretty hard on conceptual stuff when they, like, come up with a new class or subclass that they're going to release. They go all in, do the whole thing, do it as it, you know, vibes. And you kind of end up with this real sort of stacking of stuff to the point where it can be really confusing if you're joining in later, like we were saying about the kind of comic booky metaplots as well. I'm simultaneously, it's exciting. It's that event brain again as well. It's like, oh, cool, this thing is happening. I want to be involved in that. I want to be there for that. I want to see what all these exciting new things they're doing are. And they will be exciting and cool things. But there's a little part of me that's like, oh no, it's happening again. It's happening again. Which I don't know. I mean, I can't say that it will be exactly the same as it was before, but I am wary of it.
Well, this is why this news was a little bit difficult to pass, is because it looks like they've got adventures releasing kind of constantly, I think, and related to this event for the next 6 months leading up to when this book is released, which I believe is in October. Sorry, I just scrolled away from it. Yes, the book is announced for October, War of Immortals, which is your kind of Tasha's Cauldron, Xanathar's Guide, player content focused around this event of the death of a god and mythic battles and mythic campaigns. But they've got adventures plugged into that that are releasing in, like, you know, May and July and August, you know, just like kind of constantly happening, which, as someone who's interested in Pathfinder, you know, this book kind of makes me go, oh, the art on this is sick. It's got like a blood unicorn with a sword for its horn, and it sounds very like metal, if you know what I mean, very God of War, but 80s metal version of God of War, with the God of War dying and blood raining on the mortal realm. Blah. Big chunk of armor, f-tonk, into the ground, and now it's become this place of worship or whatever. I don't know if that's the direction they're going, but it sounds cool. But I agree that I would not keep up with all the other, you know, content around it, because it just seems like they've got a constant stream, which is, you know, maybe what their fan base demands. I don't know.
It seems like a very modern way of doing things, right? The Star Wars sequels, for example, are really undergirded by a bunch of ancillary content, and you can enjoy those movies on their own, Or you can be a deep dive lorehead and you can read all the Dr. Aphra comics and the Darth Vader comics and the Rise of the Resistance ride at Disneyland. And you can play Fortnite and hear Palpatine speak and all of that stuff. And it seems like it works much better in a way that isn't Star Wars. It seems like it would work much better in a tabletop RPG where it seems like you can kind of ignore the ancillary stuff a lot more easily. And it doesn't. Yeah. It's not load bearing ancillary material.
Yeah, there was a while where, and this was more visible in media like film, right? Where it was like the Matrix has a bunch of extra textual things, like the Animatrix.
Yeah.
But if you haven't seen the Animatrix, you will not understand this scene from the movie. If you did not play our Xbox game, you will not understand this scene in the movie. It was kind of a way of trying to force people to consume all of the media that you're releasing. And then we kind of moved to, I would say that it kind of seemed to come up alongside the MCU, this approach that was more like, no, we're just going to reward you if you've seen more stuff.
Sure.
We're not going to force you. The things will still make sense if you haven't seen it. But if you have watched this TV show, if you have read this comic, if you have done this, then you'll get these little extra Easter eggs of things that we're dropping in, and it'll just make you excited because you know what that's about. And I don't think that has been held on to as strongly as it, you know, originally kind of came in. But I think we still see the legacy of that, where it's a little bit more like, this is a treat for you for indulging in more of the stuff.
It's a hard balance to strike.
Mm.
You remember webisode, webisodes?
Do I ever?
making your content work as a marketing tool as well as content, when it works well, it's great. It builds community. It builds interest. When it fails to work, or when people get sick of that, it's a cyclical thing, right? Oh, look, this hasn't been done in a while. I'm really excited for this crossover or this chain of things that I can follow. And then as soon as it's done one too many times, it becomes the worst thing that you could possibly do. And how dare you market to us rather than just giving us content? And so you have to try it every once in a while to see if it's going to work. And if it works, great. And if it doesn't, you better batten down the hatches because the internet is not kind.
Just a little kind of tale on that Pathfinder news being that there are two new classes available for playtest starting April 29th. The Commander and the Guardian. The Commander is a support marshal that gives movement / action bonuses to allies. And the Guardian is a tank. And I just think it's kind of cool, if nothing else, this rolling of content so that, you know, they've just finished the playtest, I assume, or you know, those PDFs are still out there for the Animist and the Exemplar, and now they're releasing two new classes to be in playtest, and then they'll finally release those in a product in 2025. So you've kind of, as a Pathfinder fan, always got, as a player, two new things to play with at any given time, you know what I mean? That you can incorporate into your game or not. And I think that's cool. I kind of like playtest packets. I like Unearthed Arcanas. I like that sort of stuff that I can just kind of cherry pick and go like, oh, that could be fun. Let's put that into the game, you know, and see what it's like. And if we like it, we can look at getting the book or not. So I have a question.
What is your question?
Who is going to develop the next Baldur's Gate game? Because Hasbro's asking that as well.
I will do it.
Very well.
Done.
Sold.
And you'll be the new president of Wizards of the Coast, too.
Yes.
Yeah, there you go.
It's played on a calculator, but by golly, it's going to be great.
Oh, yeah. Get ready, folks.
I think it's really interesting that people are up in arms about this. And people are like, without Larian, why are you even thinking about doing this? Larian didn't make Baldur's Gate 1 or 2, y'all.
Yeah.
Like,
and let them do what they want. Like, frankly, if you support Larian, let them do what they want to do. Yeah. Let them make their own thing.
That's the reason why Larian makes great games, is because they don't feel obligated to do the thing they did before. So, you know, I'm fully in support of this. Will Baldur's Gate 4 be even in the same weight class as Baldur's Gate 3? I don't know. You don't know. None of us know. See, this isn't a thing we have to have a strong opinion about until it happens. You know what I mean?
I mean, it's interesting. Quintus in chat says, I'm more interested in following Larian's next game than I am BG4.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to be true for a lot of people. I think a lot of people enjoyed the game for the creative approach that the developers took to it, not for it being a D&D game. I'm sure that whatever D&D Baldur's Gate game we get next will be fun and good. I have no doubt in my mind they're going to hire a good studio who are full of creative, intelligent people who know what they're doing, and they're going to make a great game. I don't know that the people who are going, well, that went well, let's make another one of those. I'm not entirely convinced that those people know why it was successful or what bits were successful. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out of it. Mm. But I mean, without any other stuff to go on, it's impossible to speculate about it. It is also interesting to see the sort of ripple effect it's having on other games, in the way that it's like, there's already speculation about the next Dragon Age game, which is meant to come out this year. There's been in development for a long time. Suddenly everyone's like, okay, but how's it going to stand up next to BG3?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
It's so funny. Do they suddenly have to change everything? Like,
well, it's so funny because BioWare made the original Baldur's Gate. No, they made Neverwinter Nights, didn't they? BioWare founding people made the original Baldur's Gate games. So it's like Larian's ate their lunch. I mean, it's a really funny situation unless you're a Dragon Age fan. It's a really sad situation if you're a Dragon Age fan.
And then you're very stressed out. Yeah. Sorry, we've been
or
stressed out.
Unless you're a Dragon Age developer, then you're very stressed out. It's funny to me that the whole marketing around Baldur's Gate 3 when it was first announced originally was Sven going to Wizards of the Coast and being like, can I have this sacred, honored, franchise? And Wizards' tone was very, oh, we don't give this out to just anyone. Like, we're real careful with... And people have been pitching us Baldur's Gates for years and we've been knocking them back. So you got to give us something real special here, buddy. Then they make this amazing Baldur's Gate 3 and Wizards are like, so Baldur's Gate 4, whose game? Whose game? Who wants to take it up? I got a Baldur's Gate 4.
It's really, it's genuinely concerning. I know that they've said we're going to take our time.
Yes.
They better take their freaking time. Because the idea that we'll rush into the next one because this one was so successful is, it's very possible. And I've seen so many excellent game series be ruined by the grind of, well, we got to get another one out. We got to get another one out. It's successful. Get another one out. And also, it is bad and unhealthy for the people working on the game.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. To temper that joke a little bit, as you said, Dale, Eugene Evans, who is got a very long job title, the Senior Vice President of Digital Strategy and Licensing at Wizards of the Coast, has said that they're talking to lots of possible partners and being approached, but they are taking their time to find the right partner, but they don't want it to take another 25 years between Baldur's Gates like it did between 2 and 3.
For sure.
Yeah, I get the sense.
But if it comes
there,
out in the next 2 years, I'm gonna fight someone.
What's the bet? There'll be like a phone game, and it's like a match 3 with the faces of all the party members from Baldur's Gate 3, which has been clarified as well for people who may or may not be concerned. Whichever side of the fence you sit on, the characters, Astarion, Karlach, all our favorites. They are owned by Wizards of the Coast, not by Larian. So there is every chance, every likelihood that they will show up in a future Baldur's Gate content in some capacity.
I think that's fine. That's fine.
Rounding out this episode of the Lorecast with the question that I actually had from earlier, I'm going to treat it like an email. This week, emailing into the podcast, Ben from Melbourne emails in and he asks, now this question comes off the back of the Steve Jackson news around that company and their kind of financial position and situation, the situation around GURPS. I have a question, and this again is a genuine question.
Ben from Melbourne has
Ben from Melbourne has a genuine question, and this is a question. This is not meant to sow conspiracy theories or upset people or anything like that, even though it maybe might. I don't know. I feel like 5 years ago, anytime somebody was telling me to play a system that wasn't D&D, it was either Pathfinder or GURPS. GURPS was a game system that everybody was like, play GURPS. GURPS is great. It's that system. You can play anything in GURPS. You want to play sci-fi? Don't make 5e sci-fi. Play GURPS. You can do anything in GURPS. It's the game universal role-playing system. Like, do blah, 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 blah. And I feel like reading the name GURPS in the Steve Jackson news recently was the first time I had heard of that game in like 2-3 years. And I feel like Pathfinder is kind of the same in terms of like folks who are really into Pathfinder are really into Pathfinder and that's kind of that community, but it's not in the general conversation as much as games like Daggerheart and MCDM. These two kind of, you know, new giant games moving out into the battlefield. I don't even think I hear GURPS as much as like Fate or the universal role-playing system that Chaosium are doing. And I'm wondering if this increased competition in the industry, everybody's asking, how does it compare to D&D? Will it be the dragon killer? How will it, you know, compete with D&D? My wondering is, if it's not really going to be a problem for D&D at all, these new games that are moving into the industry are really just going to push out or take up, you know, space in the industry for other smaller games, you know, that don't have the marketing that Critical Role has and flexed quite well this past week. So that's the question. And again, I don't mean this to be this is a very long question. I don't mean it to be quantitative. I don't mean to say, is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing? MCDM and Critical Role having a negative effect on the industry? I don't think that, and I'm not asking that. But I'm just asking, is that the changing shape of the industry more than harming or drawing attention away from D&D?
One, no one is competing with Wizards of the Coast / Hasbro. They're on their own level. They're competing, as we've said before, with Disney. So let's take them out of the equation. Is the MCDM game, is Daggerheart potentially driving other games further into the shadows, GURPS, even Pathfinder? Yes and no. Because MCDM's game and Daggerheart are targeting a different audience than plays GURPS. And in some cases, that plays Pathfinder. We are hoping, the royal we, are hoping that instead of competing with each other, they are just providing new players into the ecosystem. So I hope Daggerheart is bringing in players that would never have played Pathfinder or GURPS or Fate or any of these other games, but now the industry is better for having them in it. That's the best case scenario. The worst case scenario is it's just dividing up an already small and insular industry and audience even more. And I think it's more the former than the latter, because I think that, you know, the 18-year-old who got into D&D, got into gaming by watching Critical Role or watching online games, they have no idea what GURPS is and they never will. The chances of them going and playing a GURPS campaign is probably 0.0001%. So if they come in, it's not hurting Steve Jackson. It's not hurting Paizo. And maybe it's helping them a little in the long run, but who knows?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing because in the past times, it was a different situation in terms of new players, right? Instead of there being this influx of new players, there was kind of a steady little trickle of new players who would be introduced by their older siblings, by their friend that they met on the bus or whatever, you know. But there weren't that many new people coming in. It was more that you've got kind of this specific audience of people who are the kind of nerds who play tabletop RPGs. And those people, once they start playing, can become interested in other tabletop RPGs and they find things like GURPS that way. Whereas now it's that audience still exists, but we're seeing so many new players who are coming to it from a different angle. And for those players, something like GURPS, so like Ben specifically, neither of the other, Ben, can you tell me what GURPS stands for off the top of your head right now?
I think it's Universal Role Playing System, but I don't know what the G is.
Generic.
Yeah, okay.
Ah.
See, the G stands for GURPS.
But you see what I mean, right? It's like, it's hard to think, okay, what does this stand for? It's a weird acronym. And then once you do get it, you're like, okay, this is a lot of like technical language versus something like D&D. What does it stand for? Dungeons and Dragons. And that makes you go, ooh. And it tells you something about the game. You know what I mean? Whereas generic universal role-playing system, you're like, oh, okay, so then what is it? Right?
GURPS there's also this sounds extra like I layer. Burped.
It does. And there's sort of this extra layer of difficulty for someone completely new to this sort of this subculture to get into. And there's this sense of like complexity that makes it a little bit more impenetrable. So I think it's more that the new audience aren't coming to games like that in the same way that they're coming to games that have these, you know, fantastical evocative names.
I wonder sometimes about the way people get into role-playing games. We've talked a lot about how D&D is competing with Disney and how everything else is competing with the rest of the RPG market. I think that's true, right? Because you look at Marvel films, MCU films, there's been a lot of study dedicated to how many people that watch MCU films go on to read Marvel comics. And it's not many of them. So you get people watching the D&D movie, getting into D&D, the property, they're probably not going to go on to expand their RPG taste beyond D&D. That's not saying they won't, right? There's probably a significant passion for RPGs that gets developed through that, but the percentage-wise numbers, you're probably going to get some really huge RPG heads that watch a D&D movie, play D&D, discover the rest of the RPG sphere, and they got super into it. But what fraction of 1% of people who did that is it going to be? So it's not a bad thing for RPGs as a whole. It's a great thing, but RPGs are still just a really small and fairly niche market at the end of the day.
Why is that? I mean, you might have just answered this question in your answer there, but like, why is that different from video games, right? Because you know, Fallout's just come out, and I believe Fallout 4 is like breaking its own records in terms of number of consecutive players. The same happened with Cyberpunk 76, the video game specifically. Cyberpunk 76? No, I'm confusing Fallout and Cyberpunk. Cyberpunk 2077. It blew up when that Netflix series dropped. I guess the answer is A, role-playing games around a tabletop are a more niche kind of hobby, and B, they require more effort than downloading a game and playing. You need to get a group of friends together and, execute and learn the rules of the game that aren't just taught to you by using the controller, you know?
That might be it, right? I mean, time and time again, we run up into the problem, so-called, of it being hard to get a gaming group together. It's why big companies are doubtless looking for AI dungeon masters, because if you can remove that barrier to entry, then bam, look at this untapped market of players that you can onboard instantaneously.
I was just going to say, an AI dungeon master is a video game.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. exactly. You lose out on what makes RPGs legitimately special. It's a necessary friction. Game designers love to talk about friction. It's a necessary friction that makes the experience what it is, rather than it being something else entirely.
And that's the way the cookie crumbles. If you want to send an email like Ben did to the Eldritch Lorecast, James, where would they send that email?
They'd send it to mail at Oh, shoot. I wasn't ready.
podcast@ghostwiregaming.com.
There you go. I always look for whoever looks the least ready whenever I ask that question.
It's your teaching background, Ben Byrne.
Yeah, exactly. podcast@ghostwiregaming.com. Send your emails through. I swear we'll answer them 1 week when there isn't so much little tidbits of news to get through. Or you can ask a question in the comments section if you're watching this on YouTube, or you can comment on Spotify. If you're watching this on some other podcatcher, you're shit out of luck. But, you know, come leave us a comment, ask us a question. Come chat with us on Twitch. We're here 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on a Monday, 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Tuesday, bright and early, 9 a.m. if you're in Australia. And if you're somewhere else in the world,
if you're in Australia on the East Coast, it's we have multiple time zones also.
That's true, but the other time zones don't matter as much.
They don't.
We don't have major cities on both coasts, you know. All our major cities are on one.
The important get wrecked, Perth. Get wrecked.
Come on, Perth's a glorified country town. Anyway, we'll see you next time. My name's Ben Byrne, here with Sean Merwin, James Hake, Dale Kingsmill, and no one from Perth. farewell. Goodbye. Apologies to AJ Wells.
Apologies to Pat's in chat. Bigger banana. What's happening? Is that the drumming? Ba-ba-da-ba-ba-da-ba.
Oh, right, yeah.
Bang-a-da-bang-a-da-bang.